Before I start the podcast, I need to send out a thank you message to all my wonderful patrons. These are people that have signed up to donate each month money to help support the podcast. I appreciate them so much. They are Sean Poole, David and Jennifer Evans, Jeff Ulmer, Sylvian Groth, Liz Brunson, Yetta, Steve Van Sack, Robert Brown, Rob Barnett, Bella Pori, John Munson, Betsy Hodges, Levi Peter, Elizabeth Brunson, Stephen Malio, Steve Rogers, Dale Hosack, Terry Smith, Chris Bloom, and Mary Thomas. Thank you guys for being part of this community. If you want to join Patreon, it's really easy. Go to patreon.com, search for Seth Lessing Bruce, and from there you can log on and sign up for as little as $1 a month. Doing that, you get a handwritten thank you note from me. At certain tiers, you get unedited episodes. You get preview episodes. And you also can join my advisory council. These are the group of supporters who get first notice of when I'm trying something new, and they are able to give us feedback on what they think of these new projects. So thank you guys for being part of this. Now then, let's get on with the conversation. Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of Seth Lessing Bruce, your podcast all about Bruce Springsteen, his music, and mostly his fans. I am your host, Jesse Jackson. We are getting off the Bruce train, though he will come up. And we are talking to a kindred spirit. Gary and I, right before I hit record, talked about we both went to high school in the 70s. And so I think we're going to talk a lot about AM radio and how the diversity that was on that radio station that you listened to. But Gary Simmons, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, my goodness. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. Tell me a little about yourself.
I guess I have to identify myself by my profession, because that's what we do nowadays. But I spent several decades as a neurosurgeon, and eventually ran a neurosurgery program at Virginia Tech. But I stepped away from the scalpel a couple of years ago and have been teaching undergrads and medical students a bunch about neuroscience, and writing some books and trying to play my instruments as much as possible. But I seem to have less time than I predicted I would. I thought I'd be there on the guitar and banjo for 3 or 4 hours a day. And I'm happy if I get half an hour right now.
I love that. So one of the things I remember, I had a guest who was a physicist, and she helped design missiles that were in rockets that were going to space. And I said, when you say it's not rocket science, you actually can say you do that. And she says, not quite, but I guess the cliche, right? It's not brain surgery. I'm sure that joke has been made many times to you.
Yeah. A lot of times. I always say, I think we get a lot of credit for the organ. The organ is magical and amazing and all that stuff. And just because we're around it, it's assumed we know everything, but I would say far from it.
Okay. All right. So Gary, I love the diverse background. We're going to have a lot of fun talking about it, but I always like to start at the beginning. So tell me, where did you grow up and what kind of music was your family listening to when you were younger?
Yeah, I love to say that I grew up in God's country, and that was New Jersey. And I did spend a couple of years in England as well when I was a kid. My mom's British. So music around me at the time was, my parents were from the Depression and then from World War II. And so it was a lot of big band, a lot of Tommy Dorsey and that sort of thing, Begin and all those types of music. And then I think there was a lot of Broadway musicals around me too, Brigadoon, My Fair Lady, that sort of thing.
And I find there's two kinds of guests the people that, and this is a generalization, they embrace their parents' music and then expand their own horizon, or the people that push back, rebel against their parents' music, and then, as I often say, and then when they're 30, they go, wow, that Johnny Cash guy that dad liked, he's pretty good. If you had to go, and are you in either category or somewhere in the middle?
I would expect somewhere in the middle. I should have mentioned as well, I was around a fair amount of bagpipe music. My mom was Scottish, and I'm probably one of the few people on earth, or at least in the United States, who actually enjoys bagpipe music. I fully intend to teach myself the bagpipes, so I have a set of pipes. And so that was there as well. And I've always actually enjoyed the big band stuff and Broadway musicals and stuff. So I've never been very exclusionary in music. I think it just always seems to grow. Anytime I hear something new that appeals to me, I have no problems adding that on. How about you? What did you grow up with?
As I like to joke in the podcast, all homage to the Blues Brothers, my family listened to both kinds of music, country and Western. I've told this story so many times that my regular listeners are finishing the story for me, but I was visiting in Ohio. I had cousins on my dad's side of the family, and they could not believe that this is 68, 69, so I'm 8 or 9, that I could not name all four Beatles.
Yeah.
Because in my house, that wasn't what we were listening to. We were listening to Hank Williams and Merle Haggard and Johnny Cash. Though my mom did love Fats Domino, Bobby Darin, some of that 50s rock and roll. So yeah, I grew up that. And then and this leads to the question I'm going to ask you. I did not control the radio, unlike, you know, my son growing up would control the radio in the car often, but not were on my spirit. We always listened to what my parents wanted to listen to. And then when I got my first AM clock radio, where I could control that dial, and I found the local AM rock and roll station and Casey Kasem Top 40. And I have often said the beauty of starting in 71, 72 till I graduated 77, you heard everything. Yes, you heard plenty of disco toward the end, but you also heard Ray Stevens, and you heard Queen, and you heard Foghat, and you heard Man and Barry Manilow. Just, it was everything there. And it was a fun time. How about you? What's your story about finding your own music?
Yeah, I'm going to jump around a little, I
guess.
Okay. But when you talk about control of the music that you're being subjected to, I had two older sisters. So they, as I'm coming of age, I guess they're teenagers. They're into the 1960s, 1970s teenage scene. So the music I heard often was their choice, which was originally the Beatles and then evolving into Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young and stuff like that. But it's interesting, for many years, I spent decades in the operating room, frankly, rarely coming out. And we almost always played music. But of course, I can't change the station. I can't put anything on because my hands are tied up. So usually it's what they call the circulating nurse who's putting on the music. So and they're all, after a while, they're much younger than me. So you get subjected to a whole slew of different musics. But yeah, as I was starting to come of age, I got the full docket sent to me, both from my sisters. And as you say, AM radio, that's what it was. And I was in the New York greater areas, WABC and that sort of thing. At the Jersey Shore, you would hear, we'd all have those little transistor radios, or
sure.
I didn't, but my sisters did. And
yeah.
And so everything you're talking about was beaming into us nonstop.
Yeah. I love that. By the way, a common theme, Gary, is siblings on this podcast, where if you're the older sibling, you influence your younger siblings. If you're a younger sibling, you are influenced by your older siblings. Sometimes there's a little bit of rebellion. If my older sibling is into this, I'm going to love punk, or I'm going to learn jazz or something just to be different. So yeah, that siblings is a common theme. I do think it's interesting because based on the TV show, which we know TV never gets anything wrong, I thought the operating surgeon got to pick the music. So yeah. I'm disillusioned.
I can't really comment because I can only watch about 5 minutes of a medical show. And all of a sudden I'm just going, this is crap. This is crap. I can't watch this. But you could be a dictator there, but that doesn't usually go over well. So I always found it made people all happier if they chose the music. And I can still remember I was at Walter Reed at the time. And this is many years later, but the Fine Young Cannibals. I got turned on to the Fine Young Cannibals because of the operating room nurse kept playing. It and I was like, some pretty good music. Wouldn't necessarily have found them without those guys. So I think you can definitely expand your horizons. But going back, I don't think I ever rebelled, but absolutely the first album that I bought, I can remember buying the first album that, and they had all those boxes of 45s. My sisters had 45 after 45, those little things in the middle that you put on the turntable. But the first album I bought, I was in junior high, and it was Led Zeppelin, Led Zeppelin II. And I thought the world turned. It was unbelievable. I've always loved Led ever since, for example.
When one of my best friends is a guy named Ken, and he did two tours of the Navy in a submarine. And he, to this day, cannot watch a submarine movie. Like he said, like Crimson Tide, he says, I have no doubt that it is wonderful performances, the actors, he said, but it's just too much wrong. I didn't understand that till there was a point in my life where I was working in a car auto insurance agency and I'm watching Fatal Attraction. And there is a scene where Ann Archer's car gets vandalized, right? And then later in the movie, she gets in a wreck. And I go, wow, their insurance is going to be canceled. That's two claims in less than 3 months.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? My wife and I, we watch a lot of these detective series. And yeah. I would imagine that a detective would turn that on and go, oh my God, turn that off right now.
I went through a spell where I was listening to a lot of TV writers being interviewed. There was a couple of podcasts that were doing that. And there was a similar theme. If they were a sitcom writer, they would watch scripted dramas or reality, like cooking shows, because if they tried to watch a sitcom, they're breaking it apart. They can't turn off the brain. Same thing.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. If you were a scripted drama, he would love sitcoms, but you couldn't watch, even though he said, no matter how good it is, I can't, like, why did they use to do an act break there? Why did you think to do that? I would have done this different. I don't know. I thought the music started a little early, right? You can't mm-hmm. turn that brain. So yeah, I could imagine that's, would be very funny.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Makes a lot of sense.
Did you always know you wanted to go into medicine, Gary?
Oh, no. I was all over the place.
Okay.
Yeah, no, all over the place. Somebody asked me the other day how I ended up in it, and I'm still not sure, to be honest. It just seemed like at some point it happened. It was in the considerations. It was in the list of things. But I went into college really actually thinking that I would go into the ministry. I took a boatload of religion courses, but I always, somewhere there, I guess I thought maybe medicine. So I took biochemistry and that sort of stuff. And then on the campus, different types of recruiters would come through. So for a while, I thought I'd go in the FBI, and then I thought I'd go into the Navy and be a pilot. And then I thought I might even go into the CIA. So I was all over the place. And then somehow one day I woke up and I'm going to medical school. So yeah, I wish I actually knew.
Was faith always important to you?
Yes and no. I went through various surges and highs and lows, you would say. The one thing that I'm afraid that doing so many religion courses did to me was it made me see all the fingerprints of human beings over all the religions, where it just felt like, it felt like every great religion at some point or another falls prey to the jealousies, the avarice, the power hunger of human beings. And so that gets all mixed in. And so it was disillusioning to believe that I can push one religion or another or herald one religion or another.
Mm-hmm. And is that why that was what led you away from being like, joining whatever, being a religious leader?
Yeah, I guess. I wish I could tell you what exactly. I just think at the time I was like a kid in a candy shop. There was just so many other potential things that felt thrilling that I thought, geez, that would be cool. Oh, that would be cool. Yeah, that would be cool. And I think I just ended up in the place that came up on the dial last. I don't think it beat out everything or anything else.
Mm-hmm.
I would be a rock star, by the way, if I had that choice, or a soccer superstar, but neither came to fruition.
Yes, the closest I've been to a musician is doing the podcast. So I feel that. So you don't know necessarily why you started and chose that path, but was there a road to Damascus moment when you decided it's time for me to stop?
Oh, yes and no. The more clear-cut point in my life, truly a road to Damascus, kind of an epiphany type experience, was when I decided on neurosurgery. I was in my last month in medical school. I was going down a completely different specialty, and I saw my first brain operation, and I was like, oh my God, I have got to do that. That is by far the best thing I've ever seen, most amazing thing I've ever seen. And I had to jump ship. I had to find a way to get trained because it's a 7-year training program after medical school. So that I remember clearly. It was really the scales fell from my eyes. And it was stupid because I had no idea what I was getting myself into. And I was getting myself into a lot. But it's one of those things where I was like, I just can't even imagine doing anything else. However, about 30 years ago now, God, how time flies. But 30 years ago, I got very sick, ironically, with a neurological illness, something called acute disseminated encephalomyelitis, where your body attacks the insulation of your own nerve cells just throughout your nervous system. And it wiped me out. And I had to fight my way back and eventually got back to everything. But there was always some background noise that I could tell things weren't perfect. And in the last few years, particularly when I get overtired, which is all the time, these symptoms would start coming out more and more. And when I started getting some double vision in the middle of operations, I started saying, you got to figure out, do you want to just hang around and be one of these guys who hangs around and tells everybody what they should do? Or do you want to just pull the ripcord? And I had neglected my wife and my family probably for a good 40 some years. And I said, I'm still with it. I don't know how long I'll stay in this type of shape. So why not get out and spend some time with the people I love? So that's how that happened.
Once you make that decision, what was the next step career-wise? What did you think about doing, not just financially, but just with your time? Obviously, you're planning to play more guitar and banjo and learn the bagpipes. But
originally, I was going to learn I think I gravitate to obnoxious instruments. So I play a lot of banjo, and they're loud. You don't make friends with your neighbors. And I actually got a accordion. I guess at the time I always like Celtic music, and kind of fiddles and accordions can fit into there. And then we really like Cajun music. We just stumbled into it at one point in our lives and really fell in love with Cajun music. So I got an accordion, and I couldn't do much with it. And then a friend of mine got a set of bagpipes, and I was like, oh, we ought to trade. And so I got my bagpipes that way. So yeah, I do plan eventually to do the bagpipes. But as I was looking at the way the world was going and stuff, I figured I hope I still have stuff to give. And I think where I had the most to give was being able to teach people stuff about what I've been doing for the last 40 years. So I do still teach a lot. I have undergraduate courses at Virginia Tech. I have medical school courses at Virginia Tech, which I do mostly online. I do mostly via Zoom, although I'll go up and check in with them in person as well. I just got done with teaching a group of retirees in a retirement home. So they're all in their late 70s and 80s and stuff, which was delightful. Try to do some community lectures. And then I've been writing books. So
what about teaching has surprised you, Gary?
You know, I think one of the things, and I guess I knew it because we were teaching anyway, we were teaching residents and medical sure. students all along. But if you hear any of my generation right now, and even the millennial generation, they're looking at whatever it is. I think it's Generation Z, whatever the kids yeah. are in high school and college right now. And they're going, they're worthless. They don't want to work. They're lazy, blah, blah, blah. They're snowflakes. They want everything done for them. And at least my experience is 100% the opposite. They are dedicated, smart, on the ball, caring, want to do the right thing. For these pre-meds that I deal with and the medical students, my God, what they did to get in, there's no way I would get into medical school now. No way. So have ultimate faith in our future generation. Their music sucks most of the time, but
okay.
But I do have a lot of faith in them.
You did mention in your notes that we were talking about that you are a Bruce fan. Can you remember when you first became aware of his music, and was there anything specific that spoke to you?
Yeah, Jesse, I was from New Jersey. You heard rumblings of Bruce back from the early days, frankly.
Yeah.
And he would pop up on the radio and stuff. I think I didn't really sink my teeth into him until college and probably late college. Then he was there at all the parties and all that sort of thing, music-wise. But really what, I don't know, did the final coup de grace when I was a neurosurgical resident. You trained for 7 years after medical school to learn how to do all the surgery and take care of the patients and stuff. And in those days, it was literally 110 hours a week in the hospital. Every third night, we got no sleep. And it was a grind. And I would come home almost totally emptied. And yet you're too wound to go to bed or anything like that. And down in our basement, we had a VCR player. And one of the first tapes we ever got was a Bruce Springsteen live tape. Do you remember this Bruce Springsteen
sure.
live tape? And it had the thing with, what's her name? The friend star was one of those.
Courtney Cox. Yeah.
Courtney Cox.
Dancing
yeah.
in the dark. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I must have played that thing 1,000 times. And for whatever reason, it was a Zen type of experience. It just was soothing. It felt good. It was just after all the toil and all that. Neurosurgery is a rough world. There's nasty things going on all the time. For me, it was uplifting. And so that just got embedded into my soul.
I always like to preface the amount of times you've seen Bruce perform live is not a fair barometer of how big of a fan you are. Have you been able to see him live?
No, zero. Partially just because of the nature of the business, 110
yeah.
hours a week. And it
yeah,
didn't
exactly.
get much better after that. It just wasn't easy. I went to medical school in New Jersey. So I guess there was some opportunity there. But by then he was all over the place anyway.
Yeah.
So no, I would have liked to, but it just never happened.
Touring this year, and he's still doing about 3 hours.
So, that's unbelievable.
Yeah, absolutely. Very nice. I'm going to go back to your childhood again. Were you a big reader growing up?
I wish I could say I was. I am a painfully slow reader.
Okay.
I would expect as a kid, there was probably some form of dyslexia there. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I still am a painfully slow reader. And I would leaf through the encyclopedia just out of interest. But God, most of my reading as a kid was predominantly comics, Peanuts and stuff like that. And I guess I was surrounded by by stories of ghosts. My mother was Scottish. Her mother lived with us. They both were firm believers in ghosts. So I think the only stuff I actually, where I read books was ghost books, pretty like Alfred Hitchcock and all that sort of thing. Were you a reader? Oh, you were on
Yes,
mute.
yeah, always. My mom would tell you that I always had a book in my hand, whether it was a comic book or a paperback or a library book, always this massive reader. And I was really a snob about I read real books, right? I
Yeah.
don't use electronic books. And I knew what I read necessarily was I really love detective novels. I really read pop culture books. And but I like a hard book till I realized that if I read my Kindle, and then later the next day I'm at work and I'm in my break room, I can pull up the Kindle app on my phone and I'm at the same place I was in my book. I went, okay, maybe I was a little foolish. So
Yeah.
since then, yeah, not being someone who was a big reader. Talk to me about your transition from, okay, I'm no longer going to be a surgeon. I'm doing some teaching, but I want to write. Talk to me about that journey.
Yeah, geez, I think I've certainly become a much bigger reader than I was. You had to be, so you had to
Yeah.
read all these textbooks and things like that. And interestingly, I really, if you were to ask what I read the most, it's mostly nonfiction. I read tons of World War II stuff because my parents were involved in World War II.
Yeah.
But if it's nonfiction, if it's fiction, I tend to read detective novels, usually English ones. I like, or the British ones. I tend to like the British ones more. But yeah, so I guess some of it was that throughout a medical career, you spend your whole time writing one way or the other. It's mostly nonfiction, but you've got to write all these things about your patients, and you got to put out medical journal articles, and you just write. You write a lot, and I think I found that I actually enjoyed it, and that people would always say, "I love your notes," and I'm like, "Really? What's so good about those?" And then I got into an element of the world that I found really interesting, and that's burnout in healthcare professionals. And worked on the concept of burnout with a world expert on it, a clinical psychologist. His name's Wayne Sotil. But I really got interested in it, and we did a lot of work in it. And then I just felt like I got to put out the news. This is important stuff. So I wrote three nonfiction books about the subject along with Wayne. And that kind of got the blood stirring of, hey, as much as I enjoy teaching, I may even be able to reach out even further with the written word because you only got so many students in a class, right?
Sure, absolutely.
Although it's a little bit of a big ego to think that a lot of people are going to read anything you write. But if you're
Yeah.
lucky, maybe a lot of people might, right? Just like a podcast, you just never know. Will it catch fire or will it not? And so I thought this may be a way to get some of the stuff out that I think is good to know just through experience. I don't try to be an oracle. It's not like I know everything, but I have experienced a lot of stuff. So I ended up writing a novel. I've got another novel on the way. I have another two cooking that I have the ideas all set out. But it's definitely going to incorporate some of the stuff that the novel that's out right now. There's a bunch of stuff in it that I think is worthwhile knowing. It's a, of all things, of course, it's about a brain surgeon. But one of the things I want people to contemplate when they read the novel is just how fragile life is, just how we can be enjoying all that we have one second, and the next second it can be just torn to shreds by disease, by trauma, that sort of thing. And it's probably a good idea to cherish it and cherish the people that you love. And I just feel like, well, that's not a bad message to get out. So that's kind of part of why I went into that.
The name of the novel?
The novel is called Death's Pale Flag.
Okay. And it just recently published, correct?
This past year, yeah. It's about a brain surgeon who's he starts to come off the rails when he believes he's experiencing a bunch of ghosts.
Nice. Okay, I'm intrigued. That sounds good. What obviously writing nonfiction and writing fiction, I assume, uses different muscles.
Yeah, it's a good point. I'm not really the person to really plumb its depths just because I'm a rank amateur in fiction part of it. So when I decided to shift into fictional books, I went and bought a whole bunch of books, Stephen King's How to Write and all that sort of thing. But there's a lot of books out there because I had no idea and I still have no idea, but it is definitely different. And what, at least for me, is it got to the point where writing nonfiction felt like I was back in high school and I was doing book reports. And
Wow.
I'm just like,
Okay.
yeah, I'm just like, oh man, this is just work. And some teacher's going to grade it or something. What happened when I started the nonfiction book is it exploded. I sat down, and my wife would tell you, I would sit down at 8 in the morning, start writing, and not even realize. And I'd stand up and feel stiff, and I'd look up at the clock, and it was 5 or 6. And I would gone an entire day writing. So for me, it certainly was this massive liberating experience because I didn't have to stay in the navigational beacons. I could go anywhere I want. People could do anything they wanted. You could just, the stories exploded. So even like with this novel, when I first finished it, it was 2.5 times its current length. And I sent it out because I had no idea what I was doing. I sent it out to these people called developmental editors. And they took a look and they said, "Is your name Stephen King?" And I said, "No." And they said, "Don't think anybody's ever going to pick this up with that many words." So I went through the painful but really interesting experience of slicing and dicing your book. But it's a thrill. So to your question, to me, it's a totally different experience. And it's thrilling and invigorating. And I can't get enough. It's like a drug.
One of my favorite things, I'm a big J. Michael Straczynski fan, wrote Babylon 5 and other TV shows. He did a Be a Writer, Stay a Writer, I think is the name of it, but it's a book on writing. And he did one chapter about editing, and he showed it unedited and then showed like how much he cut and everything to try to show that you're cutting this down to find that. I remember I've reading people like they'll do, it's a 50 word story. It has to be 50 words, right? So for that discipline of I can't do 49, can't do 51, got to tell the story. So yeah, I think it would be fun. You remind me a little bit when my son was in Cub Scouts, then he started doing Boy Scouts. And after a while, he came back and says, "This feels like homework, Dad. This is not fun. I'm like, I'm going and I'm trying to earn merit badges. This just feels like more homework. I don't want to do this anymore." And I was like, okay, I get it. That, and I know there are people that adore writing nonfiction and they have a lot of fun with it. But I could see that we're like, okay, this is a little more, and you still can teach and tell themes in your fiction.
Yeah, I fully concur with that. As a matter of fact, I began believing that you can do more in some ways with fiction because I think you can take somebody and put them right in where they are. Like one of my favorite novels of all time is The Caine Mutiny by Herman Wouk. And I don't know if you ever read it, but if you haven't, you should. It's like one of the best books ever written. But in the middle of it, it's a small naval minesweeper in World War II in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. It gets caught in a typhoon. And I'm telling you, you're reading that and you're on the decks of the damn thing. You're feeling the deck throw you around and seeing these walls of water rise up and go down. And I realized with something like that, that yeah, you can make the point without just having to spell it out. You can put the person right there and have them experience it and make your points that way without just having to just A goes to B goes to C goes to D.
I've not read that book. I've read Winds of War and the others by him. So I just went and threw it on my to buy list on the Kindle because that sounds a lot of fun. So you've talked about, you've got a couple other ideas in that are, they're growing, right? They're still working through. What else are you thinking? What's next for you creatively besides learning the bagpipes, of course?
A lot of it is the books.
It's, yeah.
I have a son who's a physical therapist and he runs a shop and he has a lot of retirees for patients. And he says, "My God, Dad, the retirees are the busiest people I've ever known." And that certainly seems to be the case right now. It just, the teaching stuff takes a huge amount of time. The writing takes a huge amount of time. And particularly when it gets to editors, a lot of back and forth and stuff like that. So it definitely keeps me busy. Like I said, I neglected my wife and family for a good 40 years. So we try to be able to do things. We are big music fans, live music fans. And we live now just outside of Asheville, North Carolina.
Okay.
I don't know how well you know the area, but there is a fantastic music scene around here. So you go into almost any bar, almost any night of the week in various areas, and there are really good musicians plying their trade. And it's of all kinds. I like bluegrass already because of the banjo, though I play more Celtic than bluegrass. But there's a lot of really good bluegrass bands around here, and they're just fantastic. And there's ones now that they call themselves, I don't know, sometimes they call themselves Newgrass, or they call themselves Bentgrass, where they'll take popular songs and just put it into bluegrass arrangements and stuff. It's just, it's delightful.
So
we do a lot of that.
So who are, besides local artists, are there other people that you're enjoying to follow?
Yeah, we got turned on to, for example, Lake Street Dive. Do you know Lake Street Dive?
No.
Oh boy, look them up.
Okay.
So they are a, I don't know what you would call them, semi-jazz, pop, semi-mild rock, but they have a lead singer. Her name is Rachel Price. And I am telling you, first of all, you hear her online and she's beautiful and all that. We've seen her multiple times, seen the band multiple times, and they harmonize with her tremendously. But when you see her live, her voice goes right through you. It is so rich and powerful. We love Lake Street Dive. And then what happens is if you put them on Pandora, all of a sudden it starts giving you a bunch of other ones. So another big one of ours is Nathaniel Rateliff. And the Night Sweats, do you know them?
No, I'm making notes.
Good.
Yeah.
Oh, man. You're going to thank me because these are really solid bands. Nathaniel Rateliff, they're more bluesy, harder, definitely a rock component to it as well, but definitely a good kind of deep blues component. And just, again, I guess these are all people we've seen in concert. Oh, I've got another one for you that's fantastic. But they got popularized. There's some of their songs that really have started to hit the big time, but definitely you want to see them. Very powerful, great music, great band. There's one we just saw recently that one of the members of one of the bluegrass bands around here told us about, and we had never heard of. They're called Here Come the Mummies.
Okay.
Ever hear of those?
No.
Okay, so Here Come the Mummies. They're out of Nashville, I think. I think they're out of Nashville. They play almost a New Orleans jazz, but it's amped up a million. And their shtick is they dress as mummies for the thing. They usually have, I don't know, 8, 9, 8, 10, 11 pieces on the stage. It's a big live show, really high energy, great music. A lot of the music's their own. The lyrics are suggestive. And so they're funny. But the musicianship is beyond belief. They have one part of the shtick where at some point, two guys come out on the stage and they're both playing two saxophones at once. And so the show is a huge thing. We love another group called the Brothers Comatose, and they're out of San Francisco, and they play predominantly bluegrass, but again, that kind of newgrass style, taking anything and putting it to bluegrass. They're a great show. Shaky Graves. Do you know Shaky Graves?
No.
Oh my goodness.
I'm learning all kinds of bands. I'm taking notes.
Yeah, and yeah. I guess what's going on here, we learned this. We were in Roanoke for quite a while, Roanoke, Virginia. Dave Matthews doesn't come to Roanoke, Virginia, and Dave Matthews doesn't often come to Asheville. They go to the bigger venues, right?
Sure.
And so what you get is the next step down, but what you find is these guys are fantastic musicians, and they've learned how to perform live because they're not selling millions of albums. They get around. Well, Shaky Graves is this guy out of Austin, and it's interesting when you look at him online. A lot of his songs are down tempo and they feel almost a little heavy on the minors. In live, he's super active, super energetic, a country mixed with rock, very upbeat in live. So I would thoroughly recommend Shaky as well. Just a fantastic show. Those would be some I would give you.
That sounds wonderful. That's great. Sounds like you are loving it.
Oh,
enjoying it.
Yeah, it's a pig and slop out here with the live music that comes to town.
Yeah. So you did mention you've dabbled in playing your own music. Share me a little bit about that, Gary.
Yeah, hopefully I write better than I play. I don't know. Way back when, back in medical school, I started picking up... I tried the banjo first, and the banjo is one of the... Do you play? What do you play?
No, I do not play any music at all. One of my big regrets is my dad played the guitar, and I never had the patience to sit down and learn it. If they'll talk about regrets in your lives, that would be one of mine. I would love to have gone, if I could go back in time, taken the time and tried to patiently learn the guitar and spent that. Yeah.
But you know what they say.
Yes, never too late.
Never too late. And the guitar is the easiest instrument to play, the hardest to master, right?
Right.
So you can sound... Another person we've always loved, and we've seen a million of his shows through the years, is Jimmy Buffett.
Yeah.
And if you read Jimmy's memoirs or hear him talk, I think he looked at a roommate and saw that he was getting a lot of girls just by playing two or three chords on a guitar. And
yes.
He said, I never strive to be a great musician and pick up a
right.
few chords and you can do a lot of damage. But the thing with the banjo I found is that it takes a while to sound good. And until you sound good, you sound horrible. And people hate you because it's so noisy. So I would pick it up and I would suck at it and I would pick it up and suck at it. And so it was very pockmarked. And then during residency, when I had no time and we had young kids, but there would be times where they'd be sitting in the bathtub or something and I would just pick up a guitar and start messing with it. And then I was in the Army originally as a doctor and then got out and went to a small town, big hospital, small town out in the middle of Pennsylvania. It was Geisinger Clinic out there, but the small town, you had to make your own entertainment. And there was a group of us who played soccer together, and we started realizing that several of us played instruments. So we created a garage band, literally a garage band. And we would get together and play, and we were bad, but we had a fantastic time. And we also had a practice of in those days, we would have some Jameson whiskey on hand. And if a song actually came off well, we would toast it and call it a keeper and down a shot. And you got better after a shot or two, and then you deteriorated rapidly after that.
Yeah, that's right. This, yes.
Exactly. But we actually had a band. And after a while, sometimes some songs would come off well. And one of the things I learned from that experience is I've been part of all sorts of different things, organizations, sports teams, just all sorts of different things through life. Nothing was more exciting and, I don't know, gave you more thrills than playing with a group of people and having a song actually go. Really,
yeah.
A major thrill. Yeah. So I when we left Geisinger, I've never had a band after that again. I miss that. But playing with other people is one of the great joys.
Yeah, I absolutely, the closest I get, as I said, is podcasting. I really enjoy interviewing people. I do a couple of podcasts where I have co-hosts, and that's always fun, just interacting with them, do them. In fact, that was one of my wife at first did not understand this podcasting thing. Like, why do you want to do this? And I said, and your story reminds me, her older brother said that if he could, he and his friends would go to a barn and play on Sundays just for themselves.
Yeah.
Just for themselves. They wouldn't care about an audience. They just would do that for fun. And he says, if I could do that, I would do that on a regular basis. And his high school buddies, they all scattered, right? And I said, to me, whether I get 5 listeners or 500 listeners, the idea of just me talking to someone that has a totally different background than me and explain is enough for me, the actual experience. And when I get advice, when people ask me about podcasting, the 3 things I say is, one, make sure it's a topic that's broad enough that you don't run out of things to say. Mm-hmm. You don't want to go 6 or 7 episodes and go, now what I talk about. 2, understand you're going to be bad when you start. So just start doing it and always have 3 or 4 episodes in arrears that in case something happens, you can keep doing. And 3, make sure it's a subject that you will enjoy talking about, even if no one listens. And I have a couple of podcasts where I meet with, I have 2 other friends that join me and we get hardly any downloads. But we don't care because every weekend, the 3 of us sit together and we have a blast talking. And so that's its own joy.
Yeah. And it's, I don't even know, people talk about flow or whatever, you're being in a state of flow.
Yeah.
I think it very much, it's when all of a sudden you start getting those warm tinglies and you're going, this is fun. This is a lot of fun. You do a great job on the podcast. Ultimately, it comes down to, is it enjoyable? And if you're getting a lot out of it, I have to think if you're feeling it, then an audience will feel it too. And so I can see that 100%.
Absolutely. Gary, what have I not asked you that I should have?
Yeah, this is a Bruce Springsteen deal, right?
Yes, but yeah, we certainly can talk about some of your favorite Bruce songs. You've already talked about how Dancing in the Dark was something pretty special to you. Are there Springsteen songs that mean a lot to you?
I know I'm supposed to at some point talk about or answer about Thunder Road, but Thunder Road's number one on any of my Springsteen lists. I just, something about the imagery. And again, I grew up when he grew up pretty much.
Yeah.
And in Jersey and at the Jersey Shore, I would be down the, so I know what it's like to have the roof down or the windows open and the wind blowing back your hair. And the imagery is just so evocative. Talk about also that idea of putting somebody right there. I just thought the imagery of the book is, of the song is so fantastic. So I've always loved Bruce. I play a lot of Bruce when I'm just playing on the guitar and try to sing it under my breath mostly. I guess it always still comes down to most of the songs that were on that video are the highest on my list.
Yeah.
Simply because they just got literally embedded into my soul. There is another one of Bruce, though, that I wish he had done a lot more. Maybe he did. I don't know. But I don't know. You remember, I think it was a Woody Guthrie honorary album that was put out. And he sang, okay, I think, This Land Is My Land.
This Land, yeah.
And it was great. I wish he would do more kind of that type of American, I don't know, folk or
so
whatever.
I don't know if you've seen, but a few years ago, more than that now, he did an album called The Seeger Sessions. And what he did is he got a group of musicians from different Americana bands and other stuff. And they did an album of nothing but songs that Pete Seeger had done, like Froggy Went A-Courtin', Your Money Down, Shenandoah. So that's a fun album you might enjoy. Have you ever watched Bruce on Broadway on Netflix?
I have. I've watched that Netflix piece, which is great. I really enjoyed that for sure.
Yeah.
besides Bruce, seeing you and I really come out of a similar era, I wanted to know what of that era, the 70s, that really spoke to you.
So I'm not ashamed to admit that I loved Barry Manilow's albums in the 70s and listened. I was a big Eagles fan. Fleetwood Mac a little, but if I had to choose, I would pick the Eagles. And then what really was odd, Gary, when I loved all the different Foreigner and when all these different ELO went through a spate where I loved Electric Orchestra. But I graduated high school in 77. I happened to pick up an 8-track tape of the Beach Boys' Endless Summer, which was a collection they did that was
double album.
A double album. And when I put that 8-track in my car, I had never heard anything like that in my life. I went through a spell where I loved Kiss and all these different bands.
Yeah.
And the Brian Wilson's harmony and those music. And that was my first musical obsession.
Definitely underrated, right? At least in modern times, people look back and say, oh, Beach Boys.
Right.
But unbelievable harmony.
Yeah. And then in, like everyone else, 84, 80 is when I discovered Bruce. 84, like everyone else, bought Born in the USA, drifted away. And then after the 9/11, and he put out The Rising, and he sang at that benefit concert. That spoke me. And then I saw him live for the first time in 2002. And that made me this fanatic. And then my latest is I have a good friend who loved the Drive-By Truckers and Jason Isbell. And so Jason was coming to, he'd sold out in Dallas, but I could get a ticket in Austin. So I drove down to Austin, saw Jason Isbell for the first time. And so for 3 weeks before I saw him live, I did nothing but listen to Jason Isbell. And had that same feeling I did about the Beach Boys and seeing Bruce Springsteen live. And that is my latest obsession. I just am just that Americana, his combination of rock and roll. I think his words are amazing. He's a very gifted songwriter. So that's kind of me. But the high school Jesse in 20, so I guess 21, Kiss came to Fort Worth, and for the first time in my life, there was 61-year-old Jesse watching Kiss on stage, and 16-year-old Jesse inside was ecstatic, just ecstatic to see Gene Simmons and Ace Frehley and them just do, and they did every song I wanted to hear, and it was just a blast to have that. And in 21, I got to see the Eagles live for the first time.
Wow.
They were doing the Hotel California tour. And even without Glenn, it was just here to good to see them. How about you? Is there some of those, are some of your high school, those things that you loved? Have you got to hear some of them live?
To a certain degree, yeah. I think one of the things that you said, though, that really resonates, music is just so evocative. It can put you back into another stage. I think it's so sedating is the wrong word. Calming can be. On the other hand, it can really raise you up and get you stoked and all that sort of thing. So it's so powerful. There are some books out. If you ever want to read a good book that it intertwines my world and the musical world, there's a book called This Is Your Brain on Music. It's a little dated now. In other words, there's newer research out, but it's a good background. This Is Your Brain on Music, just taking after that old ad of This Is Your Brain on Drugs. But it gets into how many different parts of your brain gets activated when you're into music. But yeah, I've seen a bunch of concerts, usually not the big namers. I guess it just takes so much work to get to see the big namers. The single best concert I ever saw, and then you're going to have to tell me yours, but the single best concert I ever saw was in a smaller venue. It was in an acoustic hall rather than in a stadium or anything like that. It was Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Remember Blood, Sweat, and Tears?
Sure, obviously. Yeah.
And oh my God, was that a great concert. The music was just beyond belief. And that was first year in college, I think. And it would not necessarily have been top on my list, but now is. I really thought they were fantastic. I don't know. There's just a whole, I was trying to come up. My brother-in-law was here the other day, and we were just trying to come up with the bands that made the 70s special, and we just couldn't stop. It just kept going. We went through dozens, and then we go, oh my God, we forgot Motown. We haven't even touched Motown.
Yeah, exactly. And
that sort of things. Yeah, they're all over the place. We saw, when I graduated from high school, so it was 75, the Beatles in Chicago, I'm not the Beatles, the Beach Boys in Chicago were touring together. And we did see them in Madison Square Garden. And again, Beach Boys are great. They're way too underestimated. And
I did that too. They were here to Dallas, gosh, probably 15, 20 years ago, where Chicago opened and the Beach Boys, then they came together and did some stuff. This past summer, Brian Wilson was touring with Chicago and he opened and then Chicago played. And that was a lot of fun. I, similar to you, so Linda and I got married in 84. In 86, we moved to Dallas. The economy was just not well. We were from a small town, Lake Charles, Louisiana. So we moved to Dallas for better economy. And around 87, 88, we discovered the local Dallas music scene. So we would go to these little clubs and hear Edie Brickell and the New Bohemians. There is a band that's still active called Brave Combo, which do rock and roll polka.
Haven't heard that one.
Yeah, they're really good. And they actually can do traditional polka as well. And they've won a Grammy for best polka album. A singer-songwriter named Sarah Hickman, who ended up being with Elektra, got released and has had a career of doing a lot of really beautiful music. And then so other local bands. And we would joke that when Billy Joel came to town, he doesn't, after the show, come up and go, Gary, good to see you again. Or, hi, I'm blank. Thanks for coming out to the show. And when you go to these local venues, they are appreciative. And they do, between the sets, they don't go necessarily in the green room. They will come out and meet with you and talk to you. And so I certainly don't think you become friends, but they recognize that, oh, it's Jesse and Linda. They come and see us all the time. Hey, what are you going to do? And I just think that is, and now I'm preaching to the choir, but listeners, if you can find that local music and support those young bands, one, it's going to be cheaper. Two, you're going to have a lot of fun. And also there's that connection to the band. So I absolutely agree. So you were going to ask me, I saw America right at, America was a trilogy, three people. And then they lost one of them and they did an album called Silent Letter, because America, all their albums always started with A's. And this was the first album with just a duo. And I just picked it up, loved it, and saw them. They were great in concert. The first time I saw Brian Wilson after he had gotten clean and healthy, he did Pet Sounds with an orchestra. Linda Ronstadt and the Neville Brothers were a double bill. Once again, child of the 70s. I was in love with Linda Ronstadt.
Absolutely.
I think many of us were. And so the Neville Brothers were amazing opening act. Then she came out and then Aaron came out. That was when they had done some songs together.
Yeah.
And they would do that. So that was great.
Nice documentary on Linda Ronstadt out there as well
right
now.
That was such well done. Yeah. Speaking of, have you gotten to see the Netflix Greatest Night in Pop?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and what that made me do, though, is that was fun as hell. But yeah, what it made me do is, I back in those days, I really was impressed by Bob Geldof, and not the Boomtown Rats. That wasn't my music style, but he was the one who got all that off the ground. And there's a couple really good documentaries about Bob Geldof, and the Band Aid was the original one that he came out with, that Do They Know It's Christmas song, and then Live Aid. So
yeah.
Once we saw the one about We Are the World, we had to watch the others, and it was really good, very moving.
Yeah, I agree, and I really enjoyed that. I was impressed with Cyndi Lauper, and Huey Lewis was really an interesting interview. Obviously, Bruce was good. I'm biased with Bruce, but it was amazing to hear Cyndi talk about it and everything. So, yeah, really good. That's super.
Yeah, there was a coda at the end of that, if you remember, which I thought was really touching. And they were saying that at the very end, everybody had cleared out and somebody went in. I can't remember who it was, but Diana Ross is still standing there.
Yeah.
And they go, "What are you doing?" And she's, "I don't want this to end." I thought that was beautiful.
I did too. I thought that was really beautiful. The idea of, because we've all been there where, whether it's a religious retreat or a concert or with family and friends, you're all get together, you rent a cabin together. It's, I just don't want to lose the spirituality, this bonding. So that's great. Yeah. Yeah.
One other thing I would tell you, Jesse, about, I'm going to encourage you to pick up a guitar and start working on it again.
Okay.
And the easiest way to get decent on a guitar would be to take a few lessons, and you don't have to. And there's also another, I think there's something else I once read about this really helped, because it frustrates me when I don't sound like Eric Clapton. And they say, well, you pick up a basketball and shoot a basket and you're not LeBron James. Why do you think you have to be the ultimate musician when you try a guitar or any other instrument? So that's, I thought that really helped. But I will tell you, going back to what you had spoken about earlier, when you're immersed in something and then you notice, you see it elsewhere, it could be anything, like we said, the detective shows or anything like that.
Yeah.
But if you're immersed in something to a degree, you notice things that you wouldn't have noticed before. And it can be very, it doesn't have to be negative. It can be very positive. Playing an instrument, and the more I play, it's definitely connected to how much I play it. But the more I play, the more I notice in all the music that was coming in externally. And it really makes you appreciate the music more, because you're hearing little tricks, little things. So you go, oh boy, that would be cool if I could do that. And you just hear it differently. And even again, with the local bands, just by doing it. So I would encourage, you like music so much, I would encourage you to get on a guitar and start picking that up.
Very nice, Gary. I appreciate that. That is a good deal. Boy, I feel like we could keep talking and talking.
we haven't covered a lot.
This is great. But before I get you out of here, I do need to ask you the Mary question. So for those of you who are checking out Gary's conversation because you're a fan of his book, or you've had him as a teacher, he made you proud. I end every podcast with the Mary question. And basically what that is, Jay Armstrong, who is an honors English teacher who's now retired, but when he was teaching, he would give his seniors the lyrics to Thunder Road, and they would read it as if it was a poem. And then at the end of the class, he would ask his students, does Mary get in the car? So Gary, that is your question. Does Mary get in the car at the end of Thunder Road?
I'll answer it after you tell me whether her dress waves or sways.
So I actually have a t-shirt that I sell on my website that says, the question isn't if the dress sways or waves, it's does she get in the car?
Okay. I may have to get that t-shirt then.
And by the way, there is, you know how there's social media going around where I'm a Bruce fan. So of course this guy did one. And I'm a Bruce fan. We agree in almost everything except one word. And he's staring at it. So I thought that was really well done. Yes. And passionate. P people are passionate about whether it sways or waves. There is not this, I don't care. No, they are like, it is. So it is very funny. So.
That is funny. To answer your question, I am a hopeless romantic. So I believe in love. I believe in human connection and all that. I'm also an optimist and I love happy endings, even if I don't mind a lot of strife in between, but I like it to come to a happy ending. And I'm like, how in the world would she turn down Bruce? So there's no question in my mind. She climbs in the car. No question.
Absolutely. I love that. That is great. All right, listeners, it is Death's Pale Flag, Gary Simmons, available wherever you find books. It sounds like an amazing novel. I'm looking forward to checking it out. Go there. If someone wants to reach you, what's the best way, Gary?
I do have a website. It's just my name. So it's Gary R. Simmons. Simmons is spelled like Simons. So it's Simonds. So it's just Gary R. Simmons, if you will, .com. And
all right.
It's real easy.
I will include that link in the show notes. This was so much fun. Thank you so much. I appreciate your time. I appreciate you sharing all the stories. It was a great conversation. Listeners, go to the website, check out the book, let them know you heard about him on Set Listing, Bruce. But for now, be safe, be kind, and we'll talk to you soon. Goodbye. Thank you for checking out Set Listing, Bruce. I hope you enjoyed our discussion of music, and I hope you check out other episodes of the podcast as well. I've spent over 7 years talking to hundreds of music fans from around the world about the power and the magic of music. Please follow me on my socials. I am still on Twitter, aka X, as @JesseJacksonDFW. The show is @SetLustingBruce. The show has a Facebook page, and I am still on Facebook as well. I'm part of a few other podcasts. On Perfectly Good Podcast, me and my co-host Sylvan are talking about every John Hiatt song in alphabetical order. My good friend Charles and I talk all things Doctor Who on Next Stop Everywhere. And each week, Lou, Karen, and I talk about Babylon 5 on Last Best Hope for Conversation. And on our JKL Media podcast, we discuss various pop culture topics. I and the show can be reached at setlustingbruce@gmail.com. And it would mean the world to me if you could send feedback on any of the podcasts. Give me your thoughts. Tell me what you like. Tell me what you dislike. Tell me what you want to hear from me. Getting to talk to people about music is a joy, and I hope that these conversations bring you a little joy, a little love, and a whole lot of light.